and then turn it over to the other committee members. I think that this, for me, this is a story that I see on a regular basis, and it's actually something that I've built into my supervision curriculum. I have developed professional development trainings for supervisees, as well as new incoming behavior analysts, of the importance of balancing your workload, understanding self-care, having those things. I mean, this is a very pertinent issue in our field across multiple professionals. And I think that that's important to take into consideration. I personally appreciate the acknowledgement of the concerns and the understanding of the steps that have taken place moving forward to help try to mitigate these concerns. However, I do want to add with that that I still am deeply concerned about the lack of communication with the board on multiple occasions. And then I also have concerns just in general about making sure that this wasn't just a one-off situation, but that we're not going to see things coming down in the future. And for me, I think that whether or not this rises to a statutory violation or a rule violation, I'm not necessarily seeing that, minus the again, the communication of the board, the need to change the address on file within 30 days, and I can default maybe to board staff about how they've addressed that in the past. But I think my personal thoughts at this point would be that we do a recommendation to the full board for a non-disciplinary letter of concern outlining the concerns that we had specific to this circumstance, so that it is documented and on file if needed. Any other questions, the committee members, or thoughts?
This is Dr. Davey. I'll just chime in. Yes, and I'm still keeping my video down just so I have bandwidth. I apologize for that, but I am here lurking in the darkness of just my name. You know, I think, one, being having gone through, you know, an experience, I think many of us on this call have kind of going from starting an agency or having been a, you know, agency of ground zero, and then really having it take off and trying to manage all of that. Is difficult. It's, I think all of us have experienced that are behavior analysts on this call, and probably others in the field and other fields. I think the important point here is that Ms. Nadalo has recognized that she had some shortcomings and has been remorseful and has taken corrective action to you know, tamper those kinds of possibilities for the future. Overall, I feel confident that she has recognized the errors of her ways based on her verbal behavior today, as well as the documentation that was provided, as well as some of the efforts that went on in responding to board staff. That being said, I agree with Dr. Wilson that there is some concern there with just not attending to mail and attending to our rules around updating addresses and such. And again, you know, we're kind of past being new as being licensed. We are almost a decade into licensure laws in Arizona. And, you know, those are pretty standard practices as you move or get married or your name changes or any of those kinds of things, to make sure you update the board around that. And so that is concerning. And so those are just my comments and reflection upon the information that was provided. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. Dr. Reitz, Dr. Stenhoff, do you guys have any additional comments?
I agree with both you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Davey. You know, based on the responsiveness from Ms. Nadalo and you know, in her statement given today, you know, I know there were some concerns about the responsiveness, but I think that, that the more current evidence suggests that there was some seriousness in this and was corrected. And I agree with the motion or the suggestion you gave earlier that, you know, we move forward to the board with just a letter of concern. And, I feel fairly confident that we're probably not going to see this again. So I think it was a good lesson learned, but, you know, let's move on. So.
And I would agree and echo everything that Dr. Stenhoff has just shared. I think that current behavior has shown a change, and several things have been put in place in terms of systems and processes so that this is unlikely to happen again, and would agree. I don't think that disciplinary action is something we need to recommend at this point, and would support what has already been suggested.
Absolutely. I would just add to that, because it would be a recommendation for a letter of concern, it is non-disciplinary. I like to think of it as kind of an antecedent strategy to make sure that you have kind of the motivation to continue to keep your changes in place moving forward. But I will go ahead and make that a motion then, that we move forward with a recommendation to the full board that we dismiss this complaint with a letter of concern, non-disciplinary letter of concern. And we will work with board staff on drafting that just specific to the documentation and kind of the lapse of communication with the board, and probably craft in there something related to the supervision period in which supervision was signed off on. But it doesn't appear that supervision was provided, and that's not uncommon in that sort of setting where it's not the same as practicing without a license, because they're able to work in the school setting. It's just that the supervision seemed to be put on hold, and that just was not indicated appropriately in the documentation. So that would be my motion for moving forward.
I'll second that.
Excellent. All in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Any further discussion? All right, hearing none, motion carries. Ms. Ndolo, and your attorney, we will, board staff will be in contact with you. Like I said, what'll happen is this will be drafted and sent to the full board. As a committee, we're unable to actually make the final decisions. Our role is to just make recommendations to the board, and then the board will actually review these facts, and they will either, they have the right to either agree with our recommendations or disagree, but these are gonna be our recommendations that we'll move forward with. All righty.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for being here, and thank you for again recognizing and taking accountability for the circumstances. It's greatly appreciated.
Thank you.
All righty. And I know we have a handful of folks joining us for the next agenda item. So we appreciate everybody's patience as we have worked to get to the agenda item. Thank you very much. We are going to now move to agenda item number 8, and that's going to be discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding responses received from behavior analyst licensure applicant supervisors potentially practicing in Arizona while unlicensed. Ms. Pakanon, would you like to provide us an overview?
Yes, Madam Chair. During your March 6th meeting earlier this year, you received or were presented with some application files, and I've attempted to illustrate the relationships in your memorandum, indicating that there were 3 applicants for licensure who identified collectively 6 individuals who had provided them with supervision. And those individuals, course, identified on the BACB experience verification forms. Subsequent to Ms. Folks checking their licensure status in Arizona and inquiring about the licensure status to the applicants. Subsequent information was supplied by the applicants to essentially establish that the supervision requirements were met, but by other individuals, other supervisors. Notwithstanding that fact, questions emerged concerning the six individuals and what specifically were their roles relative to providing supervision of what kind to the applicants. And you probably recall that at that meeting, we did have a substitute legal counsel who provided his best advice at that time under the circumstances and suggested the recommendation be that the committee recommend opening complaints against the six individuals for practicing as behavior analysts while unlicensed in Arizona. When meeting with Ms. Galvin to discuss the procedure going forward, staff had questions about that process. Ms. Galvin suggested that staff essentially insert an intermediate step in that process, whereby notification would be provided to the six individuals, affording them an opportunity to be noticed of this committee's questions and concerns, and to supply answers to those questions and concerns. And you've been supplied with those responses. Essentially, the five individuals who had provided supervision to the applicants, now licensees, Ms. Brown-Chipley and Ms. Weller, essentially they provided virtually identical responses, indicating that they were erroneously identified by the applicants as having provided them supervision for purposes of licensure, and that they did not represent to the applicants or to this board that they were licensed behavior analysts in Arizona. And then Dr. Thomas Szabo, the individual connected with the applicant, Mr. Hazen, provided a response through the program where he is employed as faculty, essentially explaining that the supervision was provided to Mr. Hazen for purposes of degree completion and for purposes of Mr. Hazen qualifying to achieve certification as a BCBA by the BACB. And that, again, that was information was supplied through the application process erroneously. So we are presenting this to you in the form, as I said, of an intermediate fact-finding effort for this committee to evaluate and determine next steps in this process.
Thank you, Ms. Pakanon. And I do want to make a comment. We have representatives from both of the colleges that we reached out to, the Chicago School and Florida Tech. And I think that this goes to show us how one dedicated they are to being a part of this process. And I think that's important because This is not always the fun part of our job when it comes to having to apply statutory requirements, but it is greatly appreciated that you guys have come forward and are wanting to participate in this conversation. So thank you very much for being here. Having said that, I will go ahead and start with, you know, just a summary of kind of where we're at right now, and then I'll open it up to the other committee members as well. And I think procedurally, Ms. Galvin, we would be able to have a conversation with these individuals, correct? Like, it's not us just deliberating. We would be able to ask questions and whatnot, correct?
Correct.
Okay, perfect. So I'm going to give kind of my overview, and again, I appreciate your guys' patience in waiting for this agenda item, because I wanted to make sure that we had Ms. Galvin here, because we aren't obviously attorneys ourselves, and we aren't able to interpret the statute without the assistance of somebody, you know, able to help us through that. And so where it stands right now, and where we're kind of stuck, and welcome, you know, kind of the conversation, is that, you know, supervisees, and we recognize that the BACB accepts supervision experience from the university in a practicum model or what have you. But essentially, supervisees are expected to obtain 1,500 hours of practice under the supervision of a behavior analyst. And here in Arizona, our statute isn't just a statute of licensure, but it's also a practice statute. So it's also that it is a misdemeanor, I think. It's a violation, I won't quote which one, to practice in the state of Arizona without a license. And the challenge that we run into is defining that 1,500 hours. If we're not going to define it as practice, then what is it? And so what happens is if that 1,500 hours, and I can take, for example, you know, maybe a student that's in the ASU program that may be going to a practicum site or what have you. The clients and the individuals receiving the actual services and benefiting from the services are here in Arizona. And so those supervisees are practicing. And in order for them to practice within the confines of the law, they have to be practicing under somebody who is licensed in Arizona. And so we're struggling with trying to figure out the best way to address the fact that the supervision potentially coming from the universities, and please know we're not, in fact, we're very familiar with your programs. We are very, you know, familiar with many of your guys' work. So it's not a question of competency by any means. It's an issue of if those individuals are required to be licensed or supervised by someone who's licensed, then how do we figure out those 1,500 hours? And so that's kind of where we're setting. And I wanted to just kind of preface that so that there was kind of an understanding. It most definitely isn't us trying to come get you and say, we got you, like, you're in our state and you're not welcome here. We obviously want to expand behavior analyst certification in our state. The reality of it is that it is a practice law, and those 1,500 hours are perceivably practicing, and that's where we're in this hiccup. So I'm going to turn it over to other committee members if you guys want to add anything, and then perhaps representatives from the university want to make a statement or provide us some information. All right. Hearing none, I'm going to go ahead and ask, let's start with Florida Tech. Do any of you guys want to take a stab or have any questions for us or have any opening statements for us?
Madam Chair, if I may, I have a statement. Is now the appropriate time for me to make my statement?
Absolutely.
Okay. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for inviting me here today to address you directly. I've submitted several documents to you that I hope you've had time to review, and I have come to this meeting in the hope of settling your concerns that I've practiced behavior analysis in the state of Arizona and thereby acted in a way that's in violation of Arizona state laws. Let me be clear, I've not. As part of my duties as faculty for Florida Institute of Technology, I provide group supervision to students in our university-approved intensive practicum class. As you know, the Behavior Analyst Certification Board allows university-approved intensive practicum programs, or IP, as a mechanism for students accruing supervised hours required before they sit for the BCBA exam. The supervision that faculty at FIT provide in our IP program is strictly related to the BACB mechanism so described. That is, the supervision is for BACB required hours. You know this, you referenced it. These are not hours that pertain to state licensure requirements. Our intensive practicum course involves two layers of supervision. The first layer is provided by faculty in group supervision format. Faculty like myself give course assignments related to the practice of behavior analysis as required by the BACB and specific to the content of the BCBA exam that students will take upon completion of their master's degree program. Faculty supervisors in IP classes have no input on treatment or interventions being provided to clients served by the student's agency. Faculty provide supervision of knowledge acquisition regarding assessment and intervention procedures required by the BACB. Students prepare case presentations in which they discuss current cases on which they work. Students detail the assessment and intervention strategies that BCBAs at their sites have instituted. Other students in the IP classes ask questions about individualized services. The faculty, myself, guides discussion as needed, summarizes, and offers academic viewpoints related to the case. For example, a student might describe a procedure their on-site BCBA instituted in which a reinforcer is offered non-contingently or frequently throughout the day at certain time intervals. Other students in class may ask why the reinforcer is not offered as a consequence for desired behavior. The faculty member will explain that the procedure that the supervising BCBA developed is an established and research-based intervention that reduces the client's need to use non-optimal ways that worked in the past to gain access to that reinforcer. The faculty member might then ask students to open and search through the BACB task list to find the procedure being discussed. Successful students will locate task list item D20, the use of response-independent or time-based schedules of reinforcement. Since the faculty's role is academic, their role is to clarify and offer an academic rationale for the effective use of behavior analytic strategies, strengthen the student's presentation skills, prompt courteous inquiries, and learn how to provide and receive constructive feedback. The second layer of supervision during a ACB university-approved intensive practicum course is provided by a BCBA on staff at the local company where the student works. The BACB requires that at least 50% of IP supervision is provided one-to-one, and our FIT program requires that this one-to-one supervision is provided by a BCBA that currently works locally on-site at the company employing our students. The local individual supervision BCBA is required by our program to be fully credentialed in their state. Florida Tech faculty do not provide this supervision, and I have never provided this service. Individual supervisors oversee the actual practice of applied behavior analysis, observe sessions, meet with supervisees, their clients, their families, etc. They provide direct applied practice oversight, in contrast to the coursework supervision the faculty like myself provide. To be clear, students discuss behavior analysis, assessment, and intervention issues in class, but treatment of their clients is at all times under the supervision of the BCBA they work with at their site. My interaction with Mr. Hazen during practicum meetings was not intended to and did not involve directing or planning treatment for clients served at his place of employment. To be admitted into a university-approved intensive practicum class, graduate students must be employed by an approved practicum site that is fully prepared to provide this supervision. Our administration team at FIT approves behavior analytic service organizations through a vetting process to assure that the organization is practicing applied behavior analysis consistent with BACB guidelines, that they have a sufficient number of board certified behavior analysts on staff to provide individual supervision, and that those BCBAs are fully credentialed in their state. As part of the IP requirements, a representative from the student's place of employment and the in-state individual supervisor sign a workplace agreement. That's one of the forms that I submitted to you. This agreement ensures sufficient supervision will be provided for behavior analytic activities. These forms are relative to degree completion, but not state licensure. If the student's place of employment is in a state that requires licensure, then that agency is responsible for abiding by the state's rules, regulations, and laws. Students at FIT are given ample information before entering our program about the need to adhere to licensing regulations, restrictions, and applicable laws in the state or region in which they work. Our FIT website maintains a current listing of all state licensure requirements for states in which our students reside and work. We state in clear words throughout all our website materials that it's the responsibility of our students to keep up on the requirements of the state in which they wish to work. In summary, Mr. Hazen was advised that his employer must have a licensed, qualified on-site supervisor to provide individual supervision. The company Mr. Hazen works for agreed with the university to provide individual supervision consistent with the requirements of the BACB's university-approved intensive practicum program. It's my understanding that Alex Hazen submitted state licensure supervision documentation to you after completing his BCBA exam and in error submitted my name as his licensure supervisor. It's also my understanding that he rapidly sent correction paperwork when he recognized the error. I wish to state for the record that I've not provided any behavior analytics services in the state of Arizona. I have not supervised anyone in the state of Arizona toward their licensure requirements, and that my supervision of Mr. Hazen was solely for the purpose of degree completion and in compliance with the national credentialing requirements of the BACB. Thank you very much for offering me the chance to address you this morning.
Excellent, thank you. Does anybody have any questions for Dr. Szabo? Hearing none.
Yeah, this is Dr. Davey. I have a couple questions, Dr. Szabo. Thank you for your statement. I guess my question is, I understand that you have in paperwork and in documentation clearly laid out that it is your position and your faculty's position to FIT that the hours that you are supervising these students, the hours of which you are providing them, let's say more of the philosophical underpinnings and the tenets of applied behavior analysis in the technical terms, that is in conjunction with working towards certification, correct? Is that my understanding? Is that correct, Dr. Szabo? And then, so the confusion then becomes where you have an individual who is working towards BCBA certification and those 1500 hours, and they are being duly supervised by someone in the state and then also someone at FIT. And then having to be able to essentially separate those hours out for that individual. So hours that would come from you would count towards BACB certification, but could not count towards Arizona licensure, as you've outlined. You are not licensed in the state and you are purporting not to practice in the state. So whose responsibility is that, I guess, is my question. Is that the student's responsibility to define those out? Is that part of your contract with them? Is that something that is reviewed? Is it reviewed annually? And what responsibility does the university have as being the institution that has the student enrolled and has found them this agency that they're working with? Can you just kind of elaborate on that for me? Thank you.
Dr. Martinez-Diaz is here as well, and he started the program that I work for, was the assistant dean at that time, and also the chair of the School of Behavior Analysis. He could probably speak a little bit more on his envisioning of this process. I can speak to my understanding of what the program requires of students and the companies that they work for. Our understanding as faculty members is that we're involved in the certification process that is designated by the BACB as the entryway into the BCBA examination, and that we're not involved in the state licensure requirements. So as a faculty member, what I can say is that I understand that some states have licensure requirements and that students must navigate the state licensure requirement obligations separately from the way they navigate the BACB's requirements for board certification. This is why the university places those requirements onto our website and invites students to work with a mentor. We have mentors on site who are separate from faculty, who help the student, first of all, ascertain that the site that they work out is prepared to provide their BACB required certification, and also help to ascertain if that particular student is, and their site is, in a state that requires licensure, and what they will need to work out with their company or outside of their company before they can apply for licensure. Dr. Martinez-Diaz, do you have anything that you want to add to that?
Well, yeah, actually the students receive a lot of information ahead of time, and we test them on it to make sure they remember it. But and it's multifaceted. So, for example, I'm the one who teaches online 3 credits of professional ethics and legal issues, and I spend a lot of time talking about the difference between ethics and the law, and also between different types of credentials, between certification and licensure, and then how in order to meet the requirements of the law, that you have to, if there's licensure in a state, that you have to not only be licensed to practice, but if you're receiving supervision from an individual while for accruing hours towards being licensed in that state, that you have to receive supervision from a licensed individual. And if you're working on cases in a state, regardless of what you're using your supervision for, you need to be supervised by a licensed individual, because they're the only ones who can practice and therefore the only ones who can supervise you. And we test them on that material. I always say we, because we always have a team. So that's one of the places where we cover all this very basic information with them. And we talk about licensure being state function, and that in behavior analysis, certification is not the state, and it's not legal. It is something different from that, that it's the profession that's regulating itself and not the state, and it's not the law. But anyway, so that's number one. Number two, before students start their practicum, which they cannot start till they've been at least, the minimum is they have to have gone through a year of classwork to start their practicum. So by then they've had a lot of information. They start getting a mentor, the services of a mentor. Mentors are advanced PhD students who typically have completed their master's already at Florida Tech, and then we keep them on as PhD students, and they work together with faculty. They're campus students. They're not distance students, and they work closely under the supervision of faculty. And they're assigned to a mentor, and the mentors are go over all these regulations with them. It's also on our website, and the different states that have licensure, and we refer them to APBA.
I'm the only one having trouble hearing him.
Are you having trouble hearing me?
I'm hearing him just fine.
Okay, sorry. Thank you.
Okay, I'm sorry. That APBA, we refer them to the APBA site because that has a lot of information about state licensure. We have information about licensure in our own web page as well. And then the mentors tell them, and then we definitely tell them that when they're getting the group supervision, that we're not supervising them on client, that we have nothing to do with how they work with individual clients or any impact in their treatment, because we do not know their clients well enough to provide that, and also because of regulations in states, we don't know even what states they're in. As faculty, we can't keep track of who is coming from what state. That would be crazy for us to do. It would be an impossible task. So we tell them, you have to make sure that the individual supervision comes from somebody in your state, that it comes from somebody in your local community. Now, some people do get, because they're in a rural area or in another country, they might get remote supervision because they don't have it. But again, we have to make sure that that's an approved practicum site. And a lot of times we do not approve that. Most of the time, we do not approve that as a practicum site. Sorry, no, because we're not confident that you're going to meet all the requirements. So we do watch out for that. So we are as careful as we can not to violate any state regulations. I'm one of the people who was there at the beginning of the BACB, started the Florida Tech program in 1998 at the first one there, at the same time the board incorporated. And I was a treasurer of the board for many years. So I've been working on being as careful as I can to ensure that we don't violate any laws or any regulations or anything. So sometimes students, despite all our efforts, get a little bit confused and make a mistake and forget, like the student must have. We have thousands of students in our online program. So once in a while, one person might forget, that was not part of my real supervision for my state licensure. And I'm sorry that that happens. I wish we could not make any of our students make any mistakes. But I know that we didn't make the mistake.
Madam Chair, can I ask a follow-up question?
Yes.
So none of the hours from the IP count towards, or none of the hours you, I'll rephrase it. None of the hours you provide through practicum in the IP count towards their certification. Is that accurate?
No, they don't. They count towards a certification, but they're not. You can do stuff in IP that's not directly related to an individual case, although you do have, the person does have clients, and it indirectly relates, because if you're giving them information about procedures and tie procedures to cases that they have, you're not telling them, this is what you should do with this client specifically. You're just saying this procedure might be effective, and then we might say you can check with your supervisor to see if it's an appropriate procedure to use with your client, but we're not directly involved in making direct recommendations about the client. We are, so it's Dr. Saba was saying academic. It's academic, but at the same time that it's academic, we do at times do say things like, this preference assessment has been found to be a better preference assessment under certain circumstances, blah, 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 blah. And then sometimes we might even say, maybe you should talk to your supervisor about it. But we're not going to talk to the supervisor about it. Right. And we're not going to mandate it. And we're not going to say, this is better. Yeah. We're very, yeah.
Dr. Stenhoff, if I may, I want to add just a little point of clarification. And I think it's very clear in the FIT practicum site agreement is that the expectations FIT has in that agreement actually exceed the direct contact expectations that are necessary. So it's one of those of whether or not the group supervision practicum class from an academic perspective is counting or not. For me, it's very clear that their direct one-on-one actually exceeds our expectations. And the reason why is because the IEP has more supervision requirements than the supervised independent practicum or independent fieldwork. Now, for ASU, one of the issues that we ran into was that because it was an in-person program, perceivably everybody in person would need to practice in Arizona, which means that the developers of that program opted to not go the IEP route and to just go the supervised fieldwork route. But in this particular case, it seems like it's clear in that consent, to me at least, that they're exceeding what we would expect for those 750 or 1,000 hours, depending on which format it is. And then it's still up to the applicant to fulfill those other 500 hours under the other guidelines. The other point of clarification that I just want to throw out there, because I want to assure the instructors here that I hear you. I am the ethics instructor for the ASU in-person program, and you can lead a horse to every single body of water in front of you to drink it. And I say that because I sat in a class this last semester just as a guest instructor, and I had three different students say, nobody ever told me the supervisor had to be licensed. And I said, for Christ's sakes, you were in my class where I teach it not once, but twice. And I make you do a scavenger hunt in front of the entire class to find the licensing information. So I just want you guys to know that, like, we most definitely hear you. We get all of that. We're just trying to navigate how that then into how we have to apply the statute and the rule.
Right.
Yeah. So like I feel the pain of it. Of like, I've written it, I've shown it, I've told you, and then.
Right. We tested on you and you answered the question correctly, and a three right. months later you just forget all about it.
All right. So are there any other questions? I think that if not, we'll go ahead and have Dr. Martinez Diaz mute himself and move to is it Dr. Neff?
Yes. Yes, thank you. I just had a recommendation. So I understand, or I think I understand, your dilemma. And I could see how maybe you could have an applicant for licensure eliminate the hours that they receive of supervision from a faculty member during group supervision. And that would probably be about a total of 25 hours, is my guess, right? 30, somewhere around 20 to 30, 40 hours, somewhere around there. But the practice that they're receiving is in your state by a licensed practitioner. And so I don't see why the hours they are receiving, those experience hours, would not count. Maybe that would be a concession.
Absolutely. Dr. Neff, and I have some thoughts around that too, but I want to give the Chicago School an opportunity to speak as well, because they may have some different documents and procedures. But if there's no other questions for any of the representatives from Florida Tech, any committee members with questions for any of them, let's go ahead and let's chat with, I don't know, Dr. Anal or Dr. Gallagher, which one of you guys would like to chime in. But I'd like to hear the Chicago School, and then I do definitely have some perspectives of some solutions.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks, committee, for letting us come here and talk. So this is Dr. Gallagher. I'm the Director of Clinical Training at the Chicago School and the head of the practicum program there. So five of the individuals that were listed are instructors under our program. So they couldn't all be here, and I hope that I can say this as eloquently as Dr. Szabo did. I don't think I could possibly compare to that, but our program meets very much, it's very similar to the online program from FIT. Our students come to us for practicum. We don't do intensive practicum, but we do the practicum level for the 1,000 hours. Our instructors are providing group supervision through the same format that we utilize that the BACB allows us to do. So our students are not receiving direct supervision. The two students mentioned within the messages that came through, or the letters that came through, were both supervised by a licensed Arizona behavior analyst, and the same one, as a matter of fact, who I believe spoke to the board at their last meeting regarding all of this. So our supervision is just that. It's group supervision through an online class that meets once a week. As Dr. Neff had said, it's 1 hour a week for, you know, the length of the practicum program, which now changes between the fourth edition and fifth edition. So it's a... now, right then, it was eight-week classes that they received, so 56 hours total they would have gotten under group supervision out of all of their supervision that they were provided, and at that 7.5% level. So they were getting sufficient amount that if you removed the group supervision, they certainly met the supervised independent fieldwork level without group supervision being included. And then post the 1,000 hours, they went on to receive the additional 500 hours outside of the practicum program that we provided. So I don't know if there's anything additional. Again, I think I would be repeating myself to talk about and probably not being able to say quite as well as the others, but we offer a very similar program to them.
So Dr. Gallagher, I do have a question for you.
Sure.
And obviously you don't have the documents that are provided to us from FIT, but I'm going to describe it for you. They do have a practicum agreement that is student specific, mm-hmm. and site specific with the university. Mm-hmm. And in here, the points to me that stand out as most important are that the workplace location, so the practicum site, agrees to facilitate and maintain communication between the site and FIT. So essentially, to address the fact of if there is a significant concern with clinical recommendations one way or another, that's mm-hmm. something that can have, you know, within our requirements or what have you, to be able to have that conversation.
Correct.
Have in here to allow the student to share their experience in mentorship meetings. So essentially mm-hmm. saying, hey, they're going to talk about the work that you're doing. Is that okay with you? And granting that permission, and then provide the student with the 1 hour weekly of one-to-one, which may look different a little bit for yours because you guys are doing the practicum and not the intensive practicum. But so do you guys have something similar signed?
Yes.
Okay, between the supervisor and the
student? Between all parties. So we have a training agreement that the student must sign, the supervisor signs, the group instructor signs, and that I sign. And each one lays out exactly what the recommendations are and the minimum requirements of each person that they'll provide. Absolutely.
And
in addition, we also have a memorandum of understanding with the agency. So the agency itself signs a contract with Chicago, and again discusses the fact that it creates sort of this one union that we can all speak about the student and have discussions whether there's difficulties from the site side or difficulties from our side to be able to communicate with them.
Excellent. And would it be safe to say that under those circumstances, because I'm trying to think back, I'm currently not supervising and haven't been. But I was a director for many years, and so I had my share of supervisees. And so would it be safe to say if a student were, a supervisee were to come to me as their practicum site supervisor and say, hey, I'm changing X, Y, and Z of this protocol because my instructor told me to, that we would have this, the supervisor, if necessary, would have the ability to contact the university and say, like, hey, we've got a discrepancy going on here, because it actually happens a lot they just change the protocol and then the BCBA comes out to the house and is like, well, what are you doing? This isn't what I taught you. And they're like, oh, well, my other supervisor told me to do it this way. Would it be safe to say that those lines of communication for your guys' program are open to address potentially student misunderstanding is what I'm going to hypothesize that it is a student understanding specific to what their role is. Because I think that I think everybody's articulated it well. We may look at something and just like you know, Dr. Davey may look at something and say, "Hey, I would address it this way," and I may look at it sure. and say, I would address it this way. That's right. going to happen, you know, in regular practice as well. Your agreement allows for those open lines of communication to address those.
Correct. Yes. And with our students, I think similar to the way that Dr. Szabo talked about it, there's a lot of case presentations and discussion about what's happening in order for the other students to even present information. But no one is presenting that information under the premise that a student should take that and sort of run with it, that they're going to have to take it back to, you know, their supervisor. And especially if they present it in a way of saying, we're having a really hard time with this particular client. You know, they might get 15 suggestions that night of some way to go back to their supervisor with them, but no one would say to them to go back and to do anything that we did. You know, just from an ethics standpoint, we don't see the child. So there's no way that we could possibly offer, just even based off of a student's presentation during a case presentation, of what the problem is. So that would not be, you know, that would not be permitted, or not only wouldn't it be permitted, but I'd say that the line of communication is certainly there, that we're not there for that purpose. You know, we're there to truly strengthen their behavior analytic skills in other ways, you know, and a lot of that portfolio typewriting, you know, understanding how to conduct an assessment and write it well, those areas. So we're doing those unrestricted hours with them and supporting them in that fashion.
So I have one question in follow-up with that. As far as then, when you're signing off on hours, then let's say that a student does 20 hours a week on site of let's just say direct ABA therapy with a client. And then you are also asking the student to write a sample treatment plan for, you know, a mock functional behavior assessment. And that takes that student 5 hours to maybe watch the videos, take the data, meet with someone for the IOA, what have you. 5 hours is probably very lenient. But so that they then say, okay, I'm going to count 25 of these hours. Who signs off on those 5 hours?
No. They would get 20 hours from their supervisor. They would get 1 hour of supervision from us, from the group class. That the work that's done in class is a course requirement.
Excellent. Thank you.
It's not something where they receive additional hours for that. It's a course requirement.
Excellent.
Yeah, we call it homework.
Yes. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Excellent. If I can add to that, the BACB requires that students develop an additional layer of idiosyncratic documentation. And so Dr. Neff and I developed a form that our practicum students complete, detailing all of their activities for the week. And on the side, they list who is the supervisor who is signing off on those particular hours. So course requirement hours are documented separately from the kind of applied behavior analysis work that is being supervised by their individual supervisor at their site.
Excellent, thank you.
Madam Chair, I have a question for you. With Alexander Hazen, I had received an email from Dr. Szabo with a signed BACB final verification form for 280 hours from 5/7/2018 to 8/19/2018. Did you need to see this?
Well, I think that information is helpful. So for Dr. Szabo, then for the 280 hours or 280, whatever it was, what were the activities that he would have been doing?
Well, it's a BACB experience verification form. So it indicates experience hours accumulated, number of independent experience hours accumulated, excluding time spent with supervisor, 252, number of supervision hours, 28, total experience hours, 280, It's marked BACB Verified University Intensive Practicum. And the experience time frame is 5/7/2018 to 8/19/2018. Supervisor's name is listed as Thomas Szabo. It's got his title, experience setting, LIFE in Gilbert. And it does have Dr. Szabo's signature on 10/9/2018.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Folks. Dr. Szabo, can you kind of explain the process of how those hours would have come about?
Yeah, Madam Chair and committee members. So the kinds of things that people do inside of our practicum classes include practice at developing data collection systems, conducting preference assessments, functional assessments, or other kinds of behavioral assessments. Sometimes we do in class in functional analyses. These are mock functional analyses where people are given roles to perform. One person is performing the role of a client, one person is performing the role of the therapist. A couple of people are collecting data, and on a Google form, everybody is inputting their data simultaneously and then evaluating the quality of the data through inter-observer agreement. Developing behavior support plans, developing task analyses and skill acquisition plans, and graphing data.
So just for clarification then, those, because that makes sense to me as far as kind of the rephrasing of my previous question. But to just make sense of it then, they wouldn't be doing those things at, like in his particular case, at LIFE, on site with LIFE. So perhaps it's maybe how that form's filled out that is the confusion? Because you didn't supervise him doing any of those things at LIFE. Those were mock scenarios that are done at the university.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Does anybody else have questions for either the Chicago School or Florida Tech? Okay. So again, thank you guys for being here, and please, you guys are welcome to stay on while we kind of talk about what next steps are going to be. I most definitely want you guys to hear the discussion and figure it out. But for now, I think we move to kind of just talk as a board and potentially with you, Ms. Galvin, of some options. So I think I said it in the previous meeting as well, I interpret the practicum class as being an academic requirement. The confusion becomes, again, when students are under the impression that their practice supervisor is also faculty. And the way that I know, you know, one of the ways that like ASU has mitigated that is that, and Dr. Stenhoff, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but is that they've just said, you know what, our practicum supervisors just aren't signing anything, because then there's no confusion. Like, you get all of your experience from this site, they sign the BACB forms, and it's that simple. I think there's a couple of caveats to that, in that it is a supervised independent field work there. So it's not the same as the intensive practicum and the practicum. And I think when we look at the intensive practicum and the practicum, which we'll still, moving forward, still have to have conversations about, because even though those things are changing, we're still going to see applicants who came under those models that come forth. I think that both of those provide additional supervision anyway. So supervision requirements are exceeded in those situations. And I'm wondering if the potential solution, and I don't know if this is doable, and Ms. Galvin, perhaps you can shed light, is that we request as additional information that agreement between the university and the student and the practicum site. Because to me, what FIT provides clear, at least for me, clear clarification of what the responsible roles and party were, and of the individuals practicing in Arizona with the population in Arizona, to me, it's very clear that that was done under Kathleen Walsh at Life and not under Dr. Szabo. So I don't know if that's an option. If we had the additional supervision documentation so that we could say, hey, yes, this person did meet the supervision requirements, and no, Dr. Szabo isn't practicing without a license because he's never met, you know, an individual in Arizona to be even able to do that. Or I think it just has to be somewhere very clear that the student understands that, because it's somebody who has had the practicum site. I have had many students that are like, well, my other supervisor. And I don't think that they're understanding the differences in that role. And it's not, again, for a lack of it not being clear, but I think that's where I'm kind of stuck. Could that be a solution? And I'm aware, we're very fortunate to have the Chicago School and FIT here present with us today, but they aren't the only programs. And I have had students go through programs with practicums that I've never spoken to those instructors whatsoever. So I know there's not an agreement in place. And so that's where it gets muddied, is I don't know that I'm comfortable just saying like, yeah, cool, this is all working and let's move on, and nobody's practicing without a license and nobody's providing any of this, when we're seeing applicants come forth that are running into issues. I think this was just that gray area of how do we define this, and could that additional document, that agreement, be sufficient in defining that for us?
What about adding something to the application that clearly differentiates between the practicum site and then the educational component of it that was described? And that would go to both the student and any professors, instructors, practicum, you know, site supervisors, that would delineate what should be recorded as far as actual supervision. I don't know if that would be helpful.
So, Ms. Galvin, my thought to that is, yes, I think that that could be. The problem is that we recently did a rule update that allows for them to submit the BACB form. And so I think that that is where the confusion is going to be, is that, like, I want to assure all of you guys, none of you guys had students that came forth and misrepresented your guys' supervision. What it was is that our rules allow for them to submit what they sent to the BACB, and that's what they provided. And so I think that's where the confusion is, and that's where I'm just wondering if we do see that it's potentially a practicum issue. I mean, we can ask the question in the application, but I don't think the supervisor's filling out necessarily has to fill out anything different. And maybe asking that question prompts board staff to request the training agreement between the university and the practicum site or something of that sort. I'm just concerned that because we've already done the rule change that allows that BACB form, that's what's gonna, exactly what we're sitting with right now is gonna continue to happen, because it's not the students. In this particular case, my other concern is we can ask it in the application. And again, this is a very confusing process for the students, and that's evident even locally. So I'm just concerned that they might still say, yep, my supervisor was, you know, Dr. Neff, and then it really not be, because they not, again, they're not differentiating that, where I think the signed agreement does differentiate.
So, Madam Chair, if I may, so what you're asking is, and I guess what I'm trying to process is, are we only permitted to hitch our wagon entirely and exclusively to the BACB form, or can we augment the form and that the fact-finding process associated with the form? Can we do that? Can we layer on another set of questions potentially? Can we authorize staff to follow up to seek clarification when a similar situation presents? Is that what I'm understanding?
Yes, Ms. Pecknon, because we wouldn't be able to modify the form or the process, because the intent in the rule would be so that there wasn't that doubling up of the work, because that's what was happening, is we'd have all these forms sent in and then people would still have to track down their supervisor again to get a second round of form signed. Mm-hmm. So the intent of the rule was to say, look, if the BACB if you sent these forms to the BACB already, we'll take those forms as well. Fine. To ease the burden of having to back-to-back just keep tracking down these signatures if the work was already recently done. So yes, it would be a process in which if it were to be flagged that, because we have in the rule, and I don't have it exactly, but we have in the rule that we have a right to request additional supervision documentation. And if we've got universities saying, no, we've covered, like we've gone through and dotted our I's and crossed our T's and we educate the students thoroughly. I mean, this particular form from FIT clearly says that it is your responsibility as the student and the practicum site person to be familiar with your laws and follow them. So it's one of those things of when it's blatantly that obvious in a document like that, could that just be the additional documentation we request?
Right. I mean, I totally understand the rationale behind the acceptance of the BACB verification form, but when what the purpose of that form is truly intended to be, and this board or this committee and this board's purpose, if those aren't entirely congruent, how do we fix where they aren't congruent? I think that's we're looking for that solution.
Yeah.
Ms. Galvin, could we not also request just like an attestation from FIT and the Chicago School of Psychology to provide us with those most recent documents and keep them abreast of how they're informing their applicants? And therefore, you know, when we receive something, you know, we can, as the board and board staff, if we note that FIT is listed as the institution involved and that there, you know, was some of the academic supervision that went on in that direction, that we could then trigger some sort of mechanism to provide feedback to that applicant that they may have erroneously filled out their application. I mean, FIT and the Chicago School are both, you know, paramount at providing online education for up and coming behavior analysts. And, you know, I don't suspect we're going to see a decrease in people taking online classes here in the future. I think we're going to see that only increase. And so given that these two are probably ones that produce the largest number of graduates in that area, perhaps we can work for something to that nature. Do you have any reaction to that, Ms. Galvin?
I think that would be appropriate. I understand from Dr. Dana Davis-Wilson, though, that there are a number of other institutions involved as well. And
I don't know if we have to have an exhaustive list, but if there are a couple other, if we identify them as a board of ones we want to reach out to and ask for this documentation, you know, if we can catch 90% of them through, you know, having five large programs across the United States proactively provide us that information, that would be helpful.
Dr. Davey, Ms. Galvin, I personally, and then I know I'll Dr. Szabo also has another comment or question, but let me just say this. I personally would rather obtain it per applicant. And the reason being is because for me, the university, and it's nothing against the university, it's about just human error that happens anywhere contractually. That's why we have audits. That's why we have all these processes. To me, I think globally saying FIT is clear, but these other universities, we don't know where they stand, could be problematic in when it comes to verification. Because what if somebody at FIT, and only using you guys because you guys are here, but what if somebody forgot to get that form signed? And now we've got a student who's confused, or we've got, like, I think that form being specific to the applicant is very important in being able to kind of cover the university. I think it's being able to cover us. It covers that practicum instructor so that we're not coming back and saying, because if we make an assumption that it got filled out and we find out it didn't, well, now we're back right where we are now of, well, who was the one that made it clear that, you know, Dr. Gallagher was not licensed? And so I almost think that, given the number of online programs that exist, the ability to go through and come up with a list and still use that as verification that this conversation with students happened is potentially troublesome for me. But Dr. Zabel, you had a question or a comment that you wanted to make.
Madam Chair, I just had a possible recommendation, and this may not help for another 12 months, but it may help as a policy moving forward from this point to recommend duplicated paperwork in the case where there is a individual site supervisor who is performing the role of a BACB paperwork supervisor and also performing the role of a state licensure supervisor, to submit secondary paperwork to that effect.
Yeah, and thank you, Dr. Zabel. Yes, we used to actually, in the role before we changed it.
I could tell. I get it.
Yep. But I still think that if it were, again, something as simple as like, no, this agreement's in place, that may resolve our issue altogether. And I think maybe, Ms. Galvin, maybe it is a question we ask on the application of, did you participate in the university practicum program? You know, yes or no. And if so, please include your training agreement with the university practicum program, because we already have the ability to ask for their supervision contract, which many of the students should have. And much of this stuff is likely also further outlined in supervision contracts. It would just be that additional documentation. But Ms. Galvin, what are your thoughts?
I would agree. And your rule under 426.404 2C7 seems to allow for you to request and receive that additional documentation regarding supervision. And I think adding a question or some sort of additional sheet as part of the application, maybe explaining the difference between the two to help focus the applicant, would go a long way in ensuring that the questions are answered appropriately and the appropriate documentation is submitted with the appropriate supervisors identified.
So as far as then the next step, so I think the first one is to resolve the matter on the agenda as it stands, and that is what we do moving forward with the potential that we have the lovely instructors on the call with us today practicing in the state without a license. And I think for me personally, I feel confident that that's not with these particular instructors what's happening. I think the documentation that's been provided to us clearly clarifies that. I understand the attempt to train the students on what it all means, because again, we have that same problem locally. So I think if we concluded that, and then I think the next step would be to add a future agenda item to address how we prevent being in this administrative position of even having this issue, and come up with language for the application and potentially guide board staff on what additional documentation. And again, I think that FIT's document that Mr. Hazen signed on May 19th, 2015 is a really good example of additional documentation we would be looking for to conclude that the instructors in this situation were not practicing in Arizona. And so that would have to be probably something we discuss on another agenda, correct?
Yes. Heidi, had the committee voted previously to initiate complaints against the individuals?
Yes, Ms. Galvin. The March 6th minutes do reflect that that was a motion. So this committee probably needs to reverse that motion.
Yeah, to make a motion to rescind the previous motion initiating complaints against the named individuals, if that's how the committee feels based upon what you heard today.
Perfect. This is Dr. Davey. I'll go ahead and make that motion.
And I'll second that motion. And I'll add in there just, again, just for a point of learning and clarification for those of you guys that are joining us. During that particular meeting, Ms. Galvin was not with us, so we had a substitute attorney who provided us the best feedback that was known fit at that time. But we subsequently received feedback from Ms. Galvin that she would prefer we not open the complaint until we gave the chance to speak with you guys. Our motion right now as it stands is that we're actually going to retract all of that and move forward. So we've got a motion and a second. All in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Excellent. Motion carries. And so what will happen now is that we will not be moving forward with any opening of complaints. And as it stands for this particular agenda item, again, I greatly appreciate you guys being here. I think it, again, is a testament to, one, your dedication to the students, but two, your open and willingness to learn the process and be a part of this conversation. So thank you for that. Dr. Davey?
Yeah, I would ask that maybe that Dr. Szabo or Szabo or anybody else that's on the call, Dr. Neef, Dr. Gallagher, and so on. Jose, I know you're a busy guy, but as we kind of explore this, if you'd be willing to, you know, sit in on some of the conversations, and because you guys are kind of at the tip of the spear, so to speak, with regard to training behavior analysts. You guys are in multiple states. I think, you know, if you have not experienced this in other states with licensure, it's bound to happen at some point that somebody's going to ask this question on the committee or on the board. So if we could encourage you to dialogue with us moving forward, that would be helpful.
Excellent. Dr. Davey, thank you. And so, Dr. Neff?
I was actually going to offer that. So you are absolutely welcome to reach out, and I'd be more than happy to assist.
Excellent. So what we'll do is we'll direct board staff to kind of keep you guys informed of future agenda items on this particular topic. We would love to have you guys join us and help us kind of craft a solution that would, again, meet our statutory and rule requirements, how we have to apply it, but also be cognizant that no one program is the same. And unfortunately, as you guys are probably aware, there are programs out there that our approach may have to be different. And I think, again, coming up with an approach that is applicable to the law, but still captures the things that we need without then having to scare all these people into thinking they're in trouble, because I'm sure it was not a pleasant email that you all received. But I appreciate, again, you guys being here, and we will have board staff keep you guys in the loop of other times that we talk about this on the agenda, so that we can kind of craft a way to work around this, but still address our obligation, because, and I'm sure you guys, if you're in licensing states are aware, our obligation isn't to the profession and the science. Our obligation is to protecting the public. And so we have to make sure that we're protecting those that are receiving services, and we have to do that through this regulatory process. And so we would welcome your guys' feedback and input and expertise as we try to navigate this, because it's definitely not intended to be a gotcha and Arizona's out to get you moment. It's really just, we have an obligation set forth by the statute and by the governor's office to protect the individuals receiving services. And so that's why we're here today. All righty. Well, thank you guys for joining us. That will conclude that agenda item.
Sorry, this is Nikita Williams. I've been quiet. I'm an affiliate of the Chicago School in their Office of General Counsel. I'm sorry, I'm not showing my camera, but I've been here in support of Dr. Gallagher. Just wondering if the faculty members will receive some documentation indicating that this is no longer an issue for them, for their own peace of mind. Will there be some kind of subsequent documentation that these faculty can receive to know that they're no longer in question about illegally practicing in Arizona? I think that would be a great compliment to the initial correspondence that they've received.
Absolutely. We can draft a letter.
Okay, great.
Thank you. Sorry, Ms. Williams, I didn't even know you were on there. I apologize. Did you have anything else to add? I most definitely did not mean to exclude you.
No, it's been a very interesting conversation, so I appreciate the opportunity to sit in.
Absolutely. Well, thank you guys. We appreciate you guys being here. It says a lot about, again, your commitment to your students, and would welcome you guys to come back so that we can figure out how to navigate this.
Great. Wonderful. Thank you so much. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. I did want to make a comment. I think you are all aware probably that because of the changes in the BACB, there's not going to be any more practicum or intensive practicum. So with students, at least in Florida Tech, that begin our master's programs in the fall of 2020, they will not have a practicum requirement as their graduation requirement for the online students or even the campus students. There won't be practicum. And then what we will have depends on the program, but it won't be practicum. So we'll be changing our procedures, and we can tell you more about them at some other time, okay?
Absolutely. Well, and that'll be good feedback as we draft this, because what's going to end up happening is we're going to have two populations. We're going to have those prior to 2022 who may be relocating to Arizona or haven't passed their exam yet or what have you, and then we'll have those under the new requirements. And so, again, that is a great point that you make, because I think that'll be very important to the conversations that we have of how we look at this, because it's different. Here in Arizona, we require 1,500 hours, and so this actually isn't, the new 2022 changes aren't a huge change for us, because we've always really required that as a minimum anyway. So I apologize that you guys are having to navigate an entirely new program. But I think that understanding that for quite some time, we will have two populations of
right.
Your feedback around that would be immensely helpful.
Right, yeah. And we'll be having two populations too, because we'll have students still under the old requirements until the people who graduate December 2022, if they don't graduate, I mean 2021, if they don't graduate by December 2021, we tell them, you're out of luck, you have to. We've been warning them.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you guys. We appreciate it. Take care.
All right, you too.
Thank you all.
Hey, by the way, a praise for your, this is a wonderful committee on behavior analysis. I was very impressed by the way you handled things. I wish all committees were like yours.
Well, thank you. And I'm sure board staff and Ms. Galvin and everybody appreciates that feedback. And you guys, they are public meetings. And so if you're a public policy nerd like myself, you can.
Yeah.
Bookmark the meeting page and put them all on your calendar and join. I mean, I did it for years just for fun.
If I ever have time, I will, because I enjoyed it.
You're welcome anytime. You guys take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.
All right, we will move on now to agenda item number 12, and that's new agenda items for future meetings. I have a few that I jotted down while we were talking. One was specific to Dr. Davies' request to potentially look into, or the need to potentially look into timelines with those BACB forms as to when someone became licensed and was eligible to supervise. So that'll be specific to board staff's process for verifying licensure dates with when they were approved and eligible to supervise. I also have that we will be looking at a couple of, I'm sure we could do a single agenda item for the application, noting that number 9 of the supervision attestation question is probably a little bit vague and could be revised to include licensed behavior analysts to help with some of the language from other jurisdictions. And then also with the application, that we look into a practical solution for identifying students that were a part of a university program. I know it's not going to be called practicum program, but we're a part of a university program that brought forth some of their hours and potentially a process for board staff for that to trigger requesting additional information specific to the training agreement between the university and the practicum site, and or the applicant's supervisor contract, because those will be the two places where we would be able to sit and really clarify what was going on. Those are the things that I have. Does anybody else have additional recommendations for future meetings? Excellent. Board staff, do you have any questions on any of those items? Perfect. If Ms. Gal, I don't see Ms. Galvin still on, but I wanted to thank her for joining us. It was super, super helpful to have her.
Thank you.
Two items. And then hearing no other questions, we can move to agenda item 13, and that is adjournment.
So moved.
Do we have a second?
I'll second.
Excellent. All in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Excellent. The meeting has been adjourned. Thank you guys so much.
So, yeah. Dr. Davies, send that cool weather to us, please.
Yeah, I was going to say I had a jacket on today. It was, and, you know, it was, I'm like cold right now and it's sunshiny. But yeah, you guys, when I see it go to like 105 multiple days, I'm like, Andrea, when can we get the heck out of Phoenix? Mm-hmm. And
smart man.
Well, and everybody's working remotely, so it works out really well. Like, you know, there's no complaints. Yeah.
That's it. We've got to get up and go camping. The problem I keep having is I have like, I wouldn't even call it morning sickness, but I am on week 22 of being horrifically sick randomly all the time. So I like live with my Zofran like right next to me and I have to like pause the video just so that nobody sees the dry heaving that goes on throughout the day. So
you need to just do a cutout of yourself like when you're more glowing and just have that as your background all the time. And then, you know,
nobody.
I think my daughter... Yeah, my daughter was talking, Emma was talking about recording like her kind of like, you know, sitting in front of her screen, like she's listening, nodding, and then just having it run on a loop in the background. So they can walk around with their headphones on and still be a part of the thing. So I'll have her contact you, Diana, to help you.
All righty. Thank you guys very much. We'll chat soon.
Stay safe, everybody.
Thank you.
Dr. Davies Wilson, could you stay on for just a sec? I have a question for you.
Absolutely.
Okay, and Heidi, of course. Okay, now we don't have a quorum. The this whole thing with the BACB final verification forms that like Dr. Szabo signed, where it's the university practicum, and there were actually three of those forms for a total of almost 700 hours. And then the other people, like some of the other instructors that were on, I looked back at those forms where we got their names, and they were signed by, I think it was Dr. Wernth the primary supervisor, and the other ones were the individual, or were the university supervisors. So could you explain to me how that works and why they were able to sign off on hours, especially listing an Arizona address, and those hours were applied towards their BACB certification, but they aren't violating our statute? I'm confused.
So the Arizona address is the problem, in that I do think that Dr. Szabo needs to verify